Okay, so let's dive into a case today that's causing like a major stir in the world of college sports. NCAA v. Alston. We've got a whole stack of articles and like legal analogies to dig through here, and it looks like this ruling could like totally reshape how student athletes are compensated.
Absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating because it really gets to the heart of this whole like amateurism model that the NCAA has clung to for so long, right? And whether that can actually hold up against like the realities of modern economics. I mean, we're talking about an industry that brings in over $18 billion annually. Yet, you know, the athletes who are really driving that revenue have historically received, you know, very limited benefits.
Yeah, you're right. It's like a total David versus Goliath situation. So, like, for those of us who haven't been following every like twist and turn of this whole legal saga, can you give us like a rundown on what NCAA v. Alston is all about?
Absolutely. So essentially, you had a group of former college athletes, right? They sued the NCAA, alleging that the rules that they have in place that limit athlete compensation actually violate antitrust laws. And specifically, they challenged the NCAA's limits or caps on education-related benefits, things like you know, paid internships, graduate school scholarships, that sort of thing.
Okay, so we're talking about the Sherman Act here, right?
Exactly. Yep.
The one that was designed to prevent monopolies and unfair restraints on trade. But how does that like apply to college sports?
Right. Well, that's where things get really interesting. So the court actually found that the NCAA, by acting as a cartel, they were basically operating like a monopsony, you know, the only buyer in the market for, you know, top athletic talent.
Monopsony, that's a word you don't hear every day. Can you like
Right.
break that down for us, non-economists out there?
Sure. Think about it. Think about it this way. If you're, you know, some high school basketball star, right? And you've got dreams of playing in the NBA. You pretty much have to go through the NCAA system. I mean, they control access to the highest levels of college basketball, which is like the main pipeline to the pros. So that means they have like enormous leverage over these athletes because really there's no other alternative.
So the NCAA is like the only game in town, and they get to set the rules,
Yeah.
even if those rules limit
Right.
how much athletes can earn.
Exactly. And that's really what the Supreme Court took issue with in Alston. They said, look, these restrictions on education-related benefits, they're anti-competitive, right? Because they're artificially suppressing the price of athletic talent.
So the court basically said, you know, NCAA, you can't just hide behind this idea of amateurism to justify
Okay.
limiting athlete compensation.
Exactly.
But they didn't like totally blow up the system, did they?
Right.
It seems like they were very specific and focused on these education-related benefits.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It seems like they were trying to strike a balance, right? They acknowledge that, you know, the NCAA does have this interest in par from about some aspects of amateurism, but they also recognize that athletes shouldn't be unfairly exploited.
Right. It seems like the court was trying to thread like a really fine needle with this decision, but it's clearly a big win for the athletes, right?
I mean, it's definitely a significant victory, right? It opens the door for schools to offer a wider range of benefits to student athletes, things that were previously off limits.
So, like, what kind of benefits are we talking about here? Give us some examples.
Sure. So now schools can offer paid internships, which is huge, right? I mean, for students who are looking to gain real-world experience in their chosen field. They can also provide graduate school scholarships, something that was previously out of reach for a lot of athletes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Those are like benefits that directly tie into
Yeah.
their education. What else is on the table?
You know, things like laptops, tablets, even, you know, specialized software, depending on, you know, the student's field of study. And then there's also the possibility of like academic achievement bonuses, which could incentivize students to, you know, really excel in the classroom.
So while this ruling doesn't allow for like direct payments to athletes, it does give them more opportunities to benefit financially
right.
from their athletic ability.
Precisely, yeah. And it's important to remember that this is really just the beginning, right?
Oh, okay.
The Alston decision has, it's really opened the floodgates for legal challenges to the NCAA's authority.
Really? So what else is, like, brewing in the legal world that could shake things up even further?
Well, there's a case called House v. NCAA.
Okay.
That's working its way through the courts right now.
Okay.
And it could have even bigger implications than Austin. This one's about revenue sharing.
Whoa, now we're talking about some serious money.
Right.
Tell me more.
So the plaintiffs in House, they argue that the NCAA's restrictions on athlete compensation
right.
violate antitrust laws by preventing them from sharing in the billions of dollars that yeah. are generated by college sports. They're basically saying, hey, we're the ones putting on the show. We deserve a cut of the profits.
So if they win, this could, like, completely upend the financial structure of
yeah.
college athletics.
It really has the potential to be, like, a total game changer. Imagine a scenario where student athletes are entitled to, like, a percentage of the revenue generated by their sport.
Right.
It would be a seismic shift.
That's a pretty radical idea. What are the chances of something like that actually happening?
It's hard to say for sure. I mean, the NCAA is fighting tooth and nail against these kinds of challenges, right?
But given what happened in Alston, it seems like they might be fighting, like, a losing battle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the court has already signaled that they're not going to give the NCAA a free pass when it comes to antitrust laws.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, the legal landscape is definitely shifting, and the NCAA is under a lot of pressure to modernize
yeah.
their approach to athlete compensation.
This is all, like, incredibly fascinating. So
yeah.
to recap, the Alston decision allows for, like, a wider range of education-related benefits for athletes.
Right.
But it also opens the door for even more fundamental changes to the system, like revenue sharing.
Exactly. And we can't forget about the potential impact of state-level name, image, and likeness laws.
Right.
You know, which are allowing student athletes to profit from their own name, image, and likeness
right.
through endorsements and other ventures.
Right. The NIL whirlwind.
Yeah.
It seems like almost every state is jumping on that bandwagon these days.
Absolutely.
Can you give us, like, a quick overview of what NIL is all about and how it fits into this whole conversation?
Of course, yeah. Essentially, NIL laws allow student athletes to profit from their own name, image, and likeness through endorsements, sponsorships, social media, you name it, right? It's a huge shift from the NCAA's traditional stance that athletes should not be compensated for their athletic abilities.
So it's like college athletes are finally being recognized
right.
as having, like, a brand value that they can leverage.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is adding another layer of complexity
yeah.
to the NCAA's efforts to maintain control over athlete compensation.
It sounds like the NCAA is facing, like, a perfect storm of legal challenges, shifting public opinion, and, like,
yeah.
evolving economic realities. It's going to be really interesting to see how they navigate this, like, turbulent landscape.
Absolutely. I mean, the Alston decision was just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
The battle for the future of college sports is just getting started.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground here, from monopsony power to revenue sharing to NIL laws.
Right.
Before we, like, dive deeper into those issues, let's take a quick step back.
Okay.
And look at the Sherman Act itself.
Sure.
How does a law that was written over a century ago to bust up monopolies
right.
like Standard Oil
yeah.
apply to the world of college sports today? I think that's a good place to pick up when we come back.
Sounds good. So, you know, before the break, we were talking about how NCAA v. Alston has really, like, shaken things up in college sports
yeah.
and to, like, really understand why this case is so important. We need to, like, take a step back and look at the Sherman Act.
Okay.
And it might seem kind of strange that a law that was written over a century ago, you know, to break up monopolies like Standard Oil could actually apply to college athletics.
Yeah.
But it all comes down to this concept of restraint of trade.
Right. Because the Sherman Act is all about ensuring fair competition, and monopolies by their very nature stifle competition.
Right.
But the NCAA isn't, you know, selling oil or steel, right? They're running college sports. So how does that fit into the picture?
Well, the court found that the NCAA, by acting as a cartel, right,
mm-hmm.
and setting, like, these really strict limits on athlete compensation, was essentially engaging in a restraint of trade.
Okay.
They were preventing athletes from receiving fair market value for their skills and their talents. It's like, imagine if you know, all the major tech companies got together and they like agreed to cap salaries for software engineers.
Right.
That would be a clear violation of the Sherman Act, right?
Yes.
And the court saw the NCAA's actions in a very similar light.
Okay, I see the parallel there. But, you know, the NCAA argued that they're not like a typical business, right?
Yeah.
They're a nonprofit organization
Right.
that's like dedicated to promoting education and amateur athletics. So, like, didn't that carry any weight with the
Yeah,
court?
not really. The court made it very clear that the NCAA's nonprofit status doesn't like exempt them from antitrust scrutiny. They're still engaging in economic activity,
Right.
right? And they still have this responsibility to ensure that their actions don't unfairly harm competition.
So the NCAA can't just say, like, trust us, we're doing this for the good of the athletes
Right.
and the integrity of college sports. They have to, like, prove that their rules have a legitimate purpose and that there's no less restrictive way to achieve that purpose.
Exactly. And that's where the NCAA really struggled, I think, to make their case. They couldn't provide like a convincing justification for their compensation limits
Right.
that couldn't be achieved through other means, like, you know, allowing athletes to market
Right.
their own name, image, and likeness, for example.
Which brings us to this whole debate about AIL or name, image, and likeness.
Right.
It seems like that's like become a major flashpoint in this whole discussion about
Yeah.
athlete compensation.
Yeah.
Can you like walk us through what NIL is all about and how it fits into this like legal puzzle?
So essentially, NIL laws allow college athletes to profit from their own name, image, and likeness through things like, you know, endorsements,
Right.
sponsorships, social media, you know, all sorts of different avenues.
Okay.
And it's basically a way for them to earn money from their athletic achievements
Yeah.
without like directly challenging the NCAA's control over team revenue.
Okay. It seems like a pretty straightforward concept, but the NCAA has been fighting like tooth and nail against it, right?
They've argued that it would fundamentally change the nature of college sports,
Right.
that it would blur the lines between amateurism and professionalism.
But with like the explosion of NIL deals, right, and the billions of dollars that some athletes are now earning, hasn't that line already been blurred?
Yeah.
It seems like we're moving towards a more professionalized model, whether the NCAA likes it or not.
That's a great point. The rise of NIL has definitely complicated, you know, the NCAA's arguments. It's
Yeah.
much harder for them to like maintain this stance that athletes shouldn't be compensated when they're already profiting from their personal brand.
So it seems like the NCAA is like caught between a rock and a hard place. They're
Yeah.
trying to hold on to this ideal of amateurism,
Right.
but the legal and economic realities are shifting so rapidly beneath their feet.
Exactly. And this raises a really interesting question, right? Like, is antitrust law even the right framework for dealing with these issues? Some legal scholars argue that labor law might be a more appropriate approach.
That's an interesting idea. How would that work in practice?
Well, if athletes are considered employees, right,
Yeah.
which the National Labor Relations Board recently ruled in a
Okay.
specific case that they are,
Okay.
they would have the right to unionize
Right.
and collectively bargain with the NCAA and universities.
Okay.
And this could lead to a more formalized system for like determining athlete compensation and benefits, similar to what we see in professional sports leagues like the NFL and the NBA.
So instead of relying on like antitrust lawsuits to like chip away at the NCAA's authority,
Right.
athletes could potentially just like negotiate directly for their rights and their interests.
Exactly.
That would be a pretty dramatic shift in power dynamics.
It would indeed. And it's a possibility that the NCAA is like very wary of, right?
Right.
They've been fighting really hard against this idea of athlete unionization, arguing that, you know, it would destroy the collegiate model as we know it.
But as we've discussed, the collegiate model is already undergoing like some pretty significant changes, right?
Right.
Driven by you know, court rulings, state laws, and the changing economic realities of college sports.
Right. It seems like the NCAA is, you know, fighting a battle on multiple fronts, and they're not having much success.
This all makes me wonder what the like the long-term implications of the Austin decision will
Right.
be. It feels like a turning point, but where exactly are we turning toward?
Yeah.
Are we headed toward a system where college athletes are treated more like like professionals
right.
with like salaries and collective bargaining agreements?
That's a big question,
yeah.
And one that I don't think anyone has a definitive answer to yet.
Let's dive into that question a bit more when we return. Welcome back to our deep dive into the changing world of college sports. Before the break, we were talking about how the NCAA is facing pressure from like all sides, right? Legal challenges, NIL deals, and even the potential for like athlete unionization. It feels like the old model of amateurism is like crumbling. So where do we go from here? What are some of the like possible scenarios for the future?
Well, you know, one path is further litigation, as we discussed. Cases like House v. NCAA, which focuses on revenue sharing, could force the NCAA to make even more dramatic changes
right.
to its compensation model.
Right, because the plaintiffs in house are basically saying, look, the NCAA and these universities are making billions of dollars
right.
off every talent and hard work, so we deserve a cut of the profits. It's a pretty compelling argument, especially in light of the Alston decision.
It is, and if the courts side with the athletes in cases like House, it could lead to a system where athletes receive a percentage of the revenue generated by their respective sports.
Wow, that would be a radical shift. It would be like turning college athletes into like semi-professionals, wouldn't it?
It would certainly blur the lines even further, and the NCAA is fighting pretty hard against this possibility,
right.
arguing that it would fundamentally alter the nature of college sports and undermine the educational mission of universities.
I can see their point, but at the same time, it's hard to ignore the fact that these athletes are generating enormous amounts of revenue
right.
for their schools and the NCAA.
Exactly. And that's why this issue is so complex, right? I mean, there are strong arguments on both sides, and it's not clear what the, you know,
yeah.
right solution is.
So besides like ongoing litigation, what are some other forces that could like shape the future of college athletics?
Well, we can't forget about the power of state legislatures. As we mentioned earlier, almost every state has now passed some form of NIL law. And that's putting a lot of pressure on the NCAA
right.
to adapt.
Right, because if the NCAA doesn't come up with like a workable national NIL policy,
yeah.
it's going to be a complete free-for-all with different rules in every state. That would be chaos.
It would. It would also create like an uneven playing field with some schools and athletes having a distinct advantage over others.
So the NCAA is kind of like stuck between a rock and hard place, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they fight too hard against change, they risk being overrun by like lawsuits and state legislation.
Right.
But if they give in too easily, they risk alienating like the traditionalists who value the amateur ideal. It's a tough balancing act.
It is. And then there's the wild card of athlete unionization.
Right. We talked about that earlier. If athletes are ultimately deemed employees, they could form unions and like collectively bargain with the NCAA and universities and that. That would be a game changer.
It would. Imagine a scenario where like college athletes have their own unions, negotiating salaries, benefits, working conditions. It would completely reshape the power dynamics in college sports.
Wow. That's a lot to wrap our minds around. So if we try to pull all of this together, it seems like there are like a few key takeaways from our deep dive.
Absolutely. First, I think the Alston decision was a watershed moment, right? I mean, it signaled that the NCAA is not above the law
yeah.
and that its traditional justifications for limiting athlete compensation are no longer tenable.
Right. The court essentially said you can't just rely on this like vague notion of amateurism to justify restricting athlete earnings,
right.
especially when you're generating billions of dollars in revenue.
Exactly. And second, you know, I think we're seeing a clear trend toward a more professionalized model
right.
of college sports driven by, legal challenges, NIL laws, and just the growing economic clout of college athletics.
It feels like the old system is like cracking under the weight of these pressures. It's hard to imagine things going back to the way they were.
I agree. I mean, the genie is out of the bottle, right?
Yeah.
The question now is not whether college sports will change, but how?
And that's a question with like no easy answers, right? There are a lot of competing interests at play.
Right.
And the stakes are high.
Absolutely. The future of college athletics is uncertain.
Yeah.
But one thing is clear. It's going to be a fascinating and transformative journey.
Well, this has been like an incredibly enlightening deep dive. Thanks for helping us navigate these complex issues.
It's been my pleasure.
And to all our listeners out there, thanks for joining us on this deep dive into NCAA v. Alston. Keep your eyes on the courts, the legislatures, and the playing fields, because the battle for the future of college sports is just getting started.